Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. For more than 3 weeks, intense fighting has raged between Armenia and Turkish and Azerbaijani forces to seize the Armenian enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh that has been a semi-autonomous region since the early 1990s after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. The territory is formerly part of Azerbaijan, but the area has ethnically and historically been Armenian. The conflict erupted in August when Azeri forces attacked Armenia proper and has since spread to Nagorno-Karabakh, where Turkish F-16 fighters and Azeri forces have been using Israeli cluster munitions and struck the cities of Stepanakert and Shushi. An Armenian counterattack destroyed the former Soviet airbase in Ganja. Russia has so far stayed on the sidelines as bloodshed has continued, but the concern is that the fighting will escalate and embroil two major regional powers, one of which is a NATO ally. Joining us today to discuss the conflict, its background, and what it all means are Ambassador Eric Edelman, one of America's most distinguished former diplomats who served as a U.S. ambassador to Turkey and Finland, as well as the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy during the Bush administration. He wears many hats today, most prominently as a counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Eric, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Vago. It's great to be here and great to be with two former colleagues and friends from my government service.
Indeed. One of those colleagues is Ambassador John Evans, another former and distinguished diplomat who served as the U.S. Ambassador to Armenia. John, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
And Eugene Rumer, who is the director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's a former National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. Eugene, always a pleasure having you on.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Eric, start us off. Turkey has long encouraged Baku to crush the enclave. Language like that has been used of 150,000 Armenians. And now we have a very well-coordinated and combined Turkish and Azerbaijani campaign that included Turkish jets being pre-positioned in Azerbaijan, where they were for a recent training exercise. French President Emmanuel Macron and other leaders have said that Turkey has been recruiting fighters from Syria and transshipping them to Azerbaijan, putting them in Azeri uniforms and then putting them on the front lines. Claims that there are jihadis involved as well. There have been recent arms shipments, which I think passed through Georgia from Israel on their way to Azerbaijan and are now being used, including cluster munitions, something which Amnesty International has confirmed. And the planning was so careful that it included Turkish reporters that have been embedded on the front line. Talk to us a little bit about this, right? What's the aim of this campaign and why is this campaign happening now?
Well, Vago, it's a little bit hard to say, you know, with any great accuracy why this moment was used to launch this renewal of the conflict that has been obviously simmering and a so-called frozen conflict since 1994. But let me step back for a second and provide some of the, I think, bigger picture changes that have enabled all this. So first, the norm, the post-Cold War norm that changes in borders in the European sphere would be accomplished through peaceful negotiation and diplomacy rather than force has been eroded. It's been eroded by Russian intervention in Georgia and in Ukraine. And more broadly around the world, you see Chinese activities in the South China Sea, see them forcibly changing the circumstances of Hong Kong. So there's been a sort of major change in the acceptance of the use of diplomacy as opposed to force and an increased reliance on fait accompli for nations to accomplish international objectives. And you see both leaders, both President Aliyev and Pashinyan in Armenia, giving voice to this. I mean, Pashinyan not long ago said Nagorno-Karabakh is Armenia, as if there was no negotiation to be held. And Aliyev said that, you know, we've noted that, you know, might makes right in today's international fear. So you've seen this, you know, on both sides. Second, the U.S. Has stepped back in this region and more broadly from its engagement internationally. And that's allowed other forces to fill voids. And you've seen that in beginning in Syria with Russia stepping in its intervention in September of 2015, along with Iran. You see it in Turkey's intervention in Libya and in Syria. Its stationing of troops in Qatar and its involvement in the Horn of Africa as well, and now in the Caucasus. So that's a second piece of it. And then the regional military balance, that is the local military balance, I should say, has shifted over the years. After the conflict originally broke out, Armenia, although smaller, was much more successful militarily than the Azeris. But the Azeris have used their oil wealth over the last 30 years to procure a pretty formidable inventory of military systems. And so you see both sides acquiring UAVs and upgrading their ability to direct indirect fire, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. Turkey has now added the use of proxy. So there's a larger kind of international ambit in which this is taking place. And my own interpretation of most things Turkish is that almost everything goes back to Tayyip Erdogan's personal political needs and requirements. He's facing a much worsening economy and dropping poll numbers. Whipping up nationalism is, always actually pretty good politics in Turkey, unfortunately. And I think that explains, some of the timing. But I would say, one thing that's really changed from previous years is that while Turkey has provided support for Azerbaijan historically, it's been largely rhetorical, political, and diplomatic. What's changed now is the willingness to use military force, including proxies, which it's used elsewhere in Libya and in northeastern Syria as well.
And Turkish aircraft, Turkish F-16s, I think went as deep as 60 kilometers into Armenia, which was something I think that most people would have considered even a couple of years ago or even a couple of months ago as something that was somewhat unprecedented. John,
I've seen the reports of the F-16s. I'd caution that I'd like to see a little more confirmation of that. But I think what's really going on, in terms of the conflict is the use of UAVs, including both Turkish and Israeli purchased UAVs. But I think I've seen reports, and I believe based on what we've seen in Libya, it is very likely that Turkish advisors are, if not controlling a lot of the Azeri UAVs, certainly helping, provide air tasking orders and mission oversight.
John, let me bring you into the conversation. You were the U.S. ambassador in Yerevan. This is sort of a, from a Yerevan standpoint, sort of the nightmare scenario that Turkey and Azerbaijan would, mount a coordinated attack on the country, and then Russia would not act despite the Russian base that's in Armenia and Russian troops that are based there. Talk to us a little bit about why this conflict matters. And because if you look at it, there isn't a lot of reporting on it. And most of the reporting and most of the coverage, even here in DC, has been seen from a much more Turkish perspective. A lot of events from think tanks. Turkey, obviously, a major contributor to most of the leading think tanks in town. So it's not surprising that Ankara's voice would be clearly heard in the course of this. But from your standpoint, what's at stake and why should people care about what's happening?
Sure. Before we get into that, though, let me just say that I think Eric did a very good job explaining some of the things that have changed in the international situation. One that always gets forgotten, we talk about norms and how borders change and so on, but people forget that in 1974, it was precisely Turkey that invaded Cyprus. And created the so far unrecognized, except by Turkey, Republic of Northern Cyprus. So it's not unheard of since World War II that these things should happen in Europe. And it's interesting that the Turkish continuing occupation of Northern Cyprus, or at least there are some Turkish troops there, that is almost a parallel for what Armenia believes it did in the case of Nagorno-Karabakh. That is, Turkey went to the rescue of its population in northern Cyprus, which was threatened at that time, with the southern part of Cyprus going for so-called enosis, that is, unity with Greece. So we have a parallel situation here. It's not exactly parallel, because what we have seen in the years since 1990, 1989, is the collapse of empire. The biggest empire in terms of geography in the world, namely the Soviet Union. And the Karabakh situation is not unique. It was the first of the conflicts to break out in the landscape of a disintegrating Soviet Union, because the roots of that conflict go very far back. Indeed, Artsakh, Mr. Pashinyan, the prime minister, when he said Artsakh is Armenia, I think what he really meant to say is that Artsakh has been inhabited by Armenians for centuries. And that's true. And you can see that when you see maps of all the Armenian churches. There are over 4,000 churches and monasteries in what became the autonomous region of Karabakh under the Soviets. And the reason was clear. It was a nod to the fact that the majority of the population there was Armenian. But because it was separated by a couple hundred kilometers from Armenia proper, it landed itself in Azerbaijan. It was an autonomous region under the new Socialist Republic of Azerbaijan, and there were a lot of tensions there between the local Armenians and Baku. And I won't go into list all those things, but they resulted in a civil movement in Karabakh for attaching Karabakh somehow to Armenia, or somehow changing the situation so that they responded or were ruled by Armenia. Now, that, of course, led to a lot of tension. There were pogroms that were launched against Armenians living elsewhere in Azerbaijan, because we need to remember that in the Soviet Union, Azeris and Armenians and Georgians and all the other 51 or two nationalities that live in the South Caucasus lived side by side. Sometimes in one ethnic group would have a village, sometimes not. But they lived fairly peacefully. They traded with each other. They were each other's teachers in schools and so on. So
Armenians were the mayors in Tbilisi for a long time.
Well, that's true, too.
Armenian community was so large, it was considered an Armenian city by some, resented by Georgians because of that.
Well, that's true. And there's also an Armenian population that's left in the southern part of Georgia. So the trouble is that when a great empire collapses and the principle of organization changes, It's no longer the Communist Party in this case calling the shots. And the principle became the national principle. That is, each titular nation of the 15 republics got a republic of its own. But it's like those nesting dolls that you see in Russia. There's always a smaller one on the inside. And that's we see that in the case of Georgia with the Abkhaz and the South Ossetians. And so that's resulted in two breakaway parts of Georgia, which haven't yet been reincorporated and may never be. The same thing in Moldova with the left bank of the Dniester River, which is much more heavily Slavic than the right bank, which was more Romanian-speaking and inclined to join with Romania. So these things are in part a product of that collapse of empire. And I would just refer briefly to the empire that used to be Yugoslavia. I won't get into those details, but some of the same kinds of historical forces were at work there once Tito died and no longer held the whole together. So we're dealing with a situation today where, for the Armenians, what happened with Nagorno-Karabakh declaring its independence, which it did, just as the Soviet Union was collapsing, both in an action by the authorities at the time and followed up by a vote which was heavily in favor of independence. The Armenians believed this was a blow for freedom and a blow for justice. But obviously, the Azeris and particularly the successive governments in Baku have viewed it very differently. In the very first days, they revoked the autonomy so that if Karabakh came tomorrow back under the full jurisdiction of Azerbaijan, it would not even have the autonomy that it had under the Soviet Union. So there are a lot of other factors that go into this. In 1992 to 94, in the war, as Eric rightly pointed out, Armenia had really the best army in the Caucasus. And so they were able to prevail over the Azeris at that time. But in the intervening years, obviously the great oil and gas wealth of Azerbaijan has been applied to building up the military. And in fact, the defense budget of Azerbaijan exceeds the entire budget of the government of Armenia. So in the long run, it's very hard for Armenia to stand up to that. But what Armenia does have, for better or worse, is terrible memories. First of all, of the Armenian genocide of 1915. When probably not quite 1.5 million, but a whole lot of Armenians were slaughtered by the Turks, still under the Ottoman regime, and then other things that have happened since then. And Armenians of my acquaintance question, why is it that the Azeris, who were not in the Ottoman Empire, why have they embraced so firmly the Turkish denial of the Armenian genocide? They weren't involved in that. And then there have been many, many instances of rhetoric on there's been rhetoric on both sides, but some of the Azeri rhetoric and some of the Azeri actions have been very disturbing for Armenians. For example, the beheadings that took place by Azeri soldiers during the April 2016 four-day war. And then one of the most celebrated instances is that of Ramil Shafarov, who was a Azeri officer who was in a NATO-sponsored training exercise in Hungary. And early one morning, he entered the room of an Armenian officer and killed him with an axe. He was sentenced to jail for murder in Budapest, but then the Hungarians were persuaded to send him back to Azerbaijan, and He was greeted as a hero, received back pay, a free apartment, and became a national hero. So the Armenians, and I'll wrap this up, but I just think it's important to say that there is a deep, deep, deep lack of trust. It's more than a lack of trust. It's fear of the Turkish neighbor. Fear that everything will be destroyed. And that gives the Armenians this existential impulse to fight to the very end and to defend their homeland. And that's what is happening right now. They are fighting like wild beasts to preserve their independence. And we'll just have to see how it comes out. I'll stop there.
John, thanks very much. I mean, a very fulsome description in terms of the history. And one of the other things, as we've seen, is unfortunately, as happens, is the case on any territory that was lost, Armenian churches and cemeteries, unfortunately, have ended up being desecrated, which then fuels into this sort of sense of, it is really do or die. Eugene, let me bring you into the conversation. You've been very, very patient. Why is Moscow not acting? Because Moscow has historically been the power broker in the region. It hasn't really liked Turkey meddling in what it considers its sphere of influence. There are those who suggest that, Putin is distracted by Navalny. Putin is distracted by COVID and what's happening in Belarus. Others say, no, Vladimir Putin would like to get involved here, but the question is at what price? Is it, for example, Pashinyan, who was put in power because of a Velvet Revolution? Does he have to go? From your sense, what is it going to take for Russia to get involved in this? Because I think there's a widespread understanding this doesn't get resolved unless Russia gets involved. What will it take for Russia to get involved?
We don't know. It could be it's because of Mr. Putin's birthday today that he is otherwise preoccupied. But we're seeing really, a series of events in what Russia has declared as its privileged sphere of interests that really make us wonder about the ability and the will of Russia to enforce that sphere. We're seeing two revolutions, one in Belarus and one in Kyrgyzstan. We're seeing an active hot war in Nagorno-Karabakh and the series of frozen conflicts that we sort of accept as a status quo. My sense is that they haven't quite come to terms with the gravity of the situation. I think they've been more preoccupied with Belarus, which for them carries a much more immediate national security kind of flavor because of the confrontation with NATO. As you said, Vago, I think the Prime Minister Pashinyan and Mr. Putin come from very different backgrounds, and there may be something to it that Mr. Putin wants Pashinyan to bleed a bit and have his back against the wall, really, and then maybe intervene to fix the situation. But I think it's really partly due to the larger context in which this conflict is now immersed. We're now seeing, in a sense, the merger of the Middle Eastern greater conflict that involves Russia, Turkey, in Syria and in Libya, with the South Caucasus, which previously were sort of two separate regional issues. Now we're seeing the two coming together. And I don't think that Mr. Putin really has quite fully figured out what is at stake here and how to deal with this situation.
Do you think that this gets resolved without Russia's direct involvement?
I don't see, the Russians don't really like to get involved in these very messy situations. I believe both Armenia and Azerbaijan neither really has been very keen on having Russia present there as a peacekeeping force on the ground. I think there's a great deal of mistrust of Russia on both sides. And it's very hard to predict these things, but my sense is that it would really take an even more aggressive and much more visible involvement by Turkey, for example, for Russia to intervene and to show that it does own that real estate.
But
the most significant development here is that Turkey is spreading its privileged sphere of interest into a critical area that Russia has always considered to be its own. So this kind of great power competition in the South Caucasus could prompt Russia to intervene more aggressively. But again, he's got his hands full.
But right, you're also sending, and Eric, I want to come to you in just a second. Aren't the Russians setting up a potential problem by allowing, for example, Turkish aircraft to operate with now impunity, right? I think both Russian and Armenian forces could shoot down those jets, but I think that there's a degree of trepidation because, you know, then the Turks are instantly going to cause this belli. And frankly, let's be honest, it's the second largest army in NATO, and it's right on the other side of the border.
I think they can shoot down that aircraft, but, you know, Turk shut down a Russian aircraft. So this could be a certain amount of tit for tat that will happen. So I also think that Mr. Putin thinks that he has some levers with which he can control Erdogan's behavior, too. So I think he is in a wait and see mode here and is not too keen to get involved at this stage until say there is a more dire situation that warrants his involvement.
Two-part question, Eric. Part one of the question is, how does this get resolved at the end of the day? Because Erdogan is known for bluster, but he's also oftentimes not particularly known for backing down, especially if, you know, you're beating up the little kid on the block, right? I mean, he tends to be more empowered in situations like that. That's question one. Question two is, you know, the concern that people have is, well, NATO could get dragged into a war with Russia. Oh, my God. It doesn't seem to me like anybody in Europe should shooting her up between Russia and Turkey over this issue, that anybody is going to be rushing to Ankara's side because there's a sense of, well, you kind of started this. Talk to us on both elements, how it gets resolved and whether if things do get unfortunately wound out of shape, whether or not there's, you know, a NATO element to this at all.
I think, let me start with the latter part first, Vago. I think the odds of a NATO dimension to this are relatively small. I mean, let's not forget that, after the Turks shot down a Russian plane, perhaps inside or maybe not inside Turkish airspace in Syria a couple of years back, people were very concerned about it. It did not escalate. Both sides, I think, want to avoid an escalation. Both sides have cross-cutting interests here. You know, to Gene's point, I mean, you know, President Putin is, kind of got his mind on other things. He's got, you know, a problem in Belarus. He's got an ongoing war in the Donbass. I mean, there's now upheaval in Kyrgyzstan that has got to get his attention because it's focused on election outcomes like Belarus. And now he's got a real hot war in the South Caucasus. I agree with Gene. People may not have in Moscow completely appreciated that the scale of the fighting or the potential that this could get further out of hand. I mean, just today, the Iranians were warning, President Rouhani was warning about the potential for this to become a much larger regional war because of shells falling on Iranian territory. Bashar al-Assad actually publicly accused Erdogan of fomenting this war. So there is a potential for it to grow regionally. But I don't think, just as President Putin has made clear that Russia's defense commitment to Armenia, which was, you know, the price of its base, does not extend to Nagorno-Karabakh, but only to Armenia proper. I don't think NATO allies who are already ill-disposed to Turkey because of its adventurism in the Eastern Mediterranean in particular. John mentioned the unresolved Cyprus issue, the expansive Turkish maritime claims in Eastern Med, its sort of a maritime Cold War with Greece and the Republic of Cyprus over conflicting maritime claims to the hydrocarbon wealth underneath the surface of the ocean and the sea. It disposed anybody in Europe to want to see this in a NATO context, nor do I think, because of the reasons you adduced, it's likely that they would see this as unprovoked. We shouldn't forget that in the 1960s, in an earlier dust-up over Cyprus, the United States, President Johnson, sent a letter written by George Ball to Turkey that basically said, if you get into trouble with the Soviet Union over Cyprus, don't expect us to come to your aid. Which had a huge shock effect in Turkey. I used to still hear about it
right.
when I was ambassador. So that's the second part of your question. To the first part of your question, you know, there's a lot of attrition going on right now. There is a potential, you know, for escalation, which is that both sides have missiles of various sorts in the 280 to 300 kilometer range, and one could imagine, you know, a kind of exchange of missiles against each other's cities, maybe not unlike the War of the Cities that took place between Iran and Iraq in the late 1980s. But I think actually, you know, time is beginning to run against the Azeris, because even with all their military buildup over the last number of years, they're moving very slowly. The terrain is, you know, pretty forbidding. You know, for those of us who've actually been to Nagorno-Karabakh and had to fly up there, it's, you know, it's this is not easy terrain, and the weather's turning. So, you know, I think the way this is probably going to come to an end is when a combination of exhaustion on the part of combatants renewed, renewed diplomatic activity on the part of, in particular, the Minsk group, which is France, the United States, and Russia, who have issued a statement, but have not been, I would say, particularly energetic. I'd be interested in John's view of that, but not as energetic as we would have been in previous administrations, let me put it that way, about trying to put an end to it. I think only then are you going to put an end to it. But I also suspect there's going to have to be some give on both sides. And given the rise of populist nationalist forces, both in Armenia and in Azerbaijan, and that's, you know, that's part of a global phenomenon, but it's true in both those countries as well. I think the space for compromise that these two leaders have is going to get smaller and smaller the longer the conflict goes on.
John, so how do you think this ends, and what's sort of the lasting solution to this? Because again, the international outcry has been remarkably muted. Nobody is sanctioning Turkey. There's no tough language. I don't even think anything is coming up in the United Nations, right? I mean, you had a supportive statement from Emmanuel Macron, obviously a very, very large Armenian population that lives in France that was driven by the Armenian genocide, which is how many of them ended up there in the first place, in part as refugees to some of the French-controlled nations in the region. How do you sense this ends, both in the short term, but then what has to happen in the somewhat longer term? Because again, at fairly regular intervals, we've seen crisis. But in this particular case, we have crossed the Rubicon where one of the largest nations in the region has become directly involved in pushing Armenians out of that area. And historically, whenever there's been talk like that, I mean, I'm sorry, I just have to raise this every time people say never again. I'm one of the people who feels that phrase should never be uttered, because we always see again, whether it's against Uyghurs, whether it's ethnic cleansing in the Balkans, or I dare say even in the Caucasus, at the end of the day, these kind of things can happen again. And I do, I'm going to ask you for a little bit of brevity, because I'm going to go around the horn and get one more question in before we have to part.
I basically agree with Eric the way he's viewing this. There's been a pattern over the last 30 years of fighting, followed by a period of negotiations in which each side tries to take advantage of what they were able to accomplish. It's sort of a pendulum effect. You're right, though, that the new factor here is Turkey's involvement, and there's a great deal of dissatisfaction with the previous method of trying to get to a peaceful solution through the Minsk group. So I think there may be some rethinking of whether the Minsk group can actually bring this thing to a peaceful solution, which is what all the neighboring states want. So I'll leave it at that. Although to add that I saw today a report that tomorrow, Thursday, and again in Geneva, and then in Moscow on Monday, the three co-chair countries will be convening meetings to try to bring this to at least a ceasefire. I haven't seen any confirmation of that yet.
Go ahead, please, Eugene.
Look, I think, you know, co-chairs are fine, but I just think of the way things used to be. You wouldn't just have the co-chairs, who typically are, no offense to any one of our colleagues, are kind of mid to senior level officials in the State Department, but you would have high level involvement from the White House, from Paris, from Moscow, but certainly the United States would lead the way at the first sign of fighting between the two. And right now what's missing is the absence of any kind of adult supervision. Again, I apologize for the condescending phrase, shouldn't have used it, but you know, any kind of interest on the part of Washington, very little interest for reasons we don't exactly know from Moscow, and some interest from Paris, but really it's pretty clear that the Russians don't want to, the United States has no interest in getting involved, and Europe apparently cannot. So that's what I think is really the root of the problem here, combined with the new ambitions of Mr. Erdogan, to which I defer to Eric, who is much more knowledgeable about that.
Well, I mean, so is it right? I mean, right, for Erdogan, I know you and I, Eric, I think maybe somewhat disagree, right? There is this sense that he has a, you know, neo-Ottoman pan-Turanism. And, you know, you may not like the reasons for the Armenian genocide, but from his standpoint, if I can just depopulate that whole area, you know, I can unite with the Turkic peoples, you know, at a time when I'm being defeated in Europe, unite with, you know, all the way over to the Chinese border. But more specifically, if I can also get, you know, Eugene went to my last question. I mean, is this what happens when the United States is completely disengaged? Is this an opportunity when China is really saber rattling very dangerously with Taiwan on an increasing basis? I mean, is this what happens when the United States is not just not paying attention and not exhibiting that adult leadership, but is so consumed in a presidential race and COVID and, you know, the latest Trump thing that the whole world, you know, that we're going to see maybe more of this than not over the next couple of months or potentially the next couple of years. Eric, and then John.
Yeah. The short answer, Vago, I think is yes. I mean, you know, we talk a lot about the, you know, liberal international order that was established after World War II, which was largely a system of alliances and a commitment to progressively freer trade and open economies that undergirded a very successful containment policy against the Soviet Union and the largest period of prosperity and wealth creation in human history. But that system doesn't just kind of turn over of its own accord. It needs an active manager, and the U.S. largely played that role until recent years. I don't want to lay all of this at the doorstep of the Trump administration, although God knows they deserve a great deal of the blame for this. But some of this goes back even into the Obama administration, and I suppose one could even trace some of it back to the late days of the George W. Bush administration. But yes, I mean, when the United States pulls back and doesn't provide the kind of leadership that Gene was just talking about, and that John and I think experienced in our own careers, then the void gets filled by other forces, and those forces tend to be not benign, but either self-interested or worse. And that's why you see the Russian role being greater in this whole Eastern Mediterranean region, of which the Caucasus in some sense are a part, a greater role than we've seen, maybe since the 1950s. Iran has expanded its role throughout the region, and now Turkey has. And the consequence is, upheaval and conflict, intensified conflict in some places. I think a series of actions are going to make it harder to resolve these conflicts, whether it's Libya, Syria, or Nagorno-Karabakh. So, yes, I think, that's sort of what you get. As to Erdogan's ambitions, yes, he has a kind of neo-Ottoman view of the world, but this man is not a strategist. And he's much more likely to, launch himself into adventures like Syria and Libya without a very good idea of what the end game or outcome is. And I think Nagorno-Karabakh is cut of the same cloth.
John?
Just to add to what Eric said, not only is the liberal international order falling apart, but one subset of it, which was the whole CSCE, later OSCE structure that started at Helsinki with the Helsinki Final Act, that has come under even more strain and has been violated. The 10 principles have been violated again and again. So it's almost ready for to be junked. But wars do end, and when they end, there has to be either a peace treaty of some sort or some process. And ultimately, no matter what Washington, Paris, or Moscow are doing, it's up to the two parties themselves to resolve this. And maybe the mediators need to just get out of the way and let the two sides settle.
How much progress have Azeri and Turkish forces made in taking back Nagorno-Karabakh? I know there are conflicting estimates on this, but the question I want to ask, and I think, and we'll wrap this here between John and Eric, right? What happens when it falls? And could there be the kind of ethnic cleansing that not just Armenians, but including American officials and others fear that this might unleash, right? So, is there a danger of that in this particular instance, or is that exaggerated? Can Turkey and Azerbaijan take Nagorno-Karabakh back, or Artsakh, as the Armenians called, as John called it, and, operate as part of an Azeri confederation without, with human rights and dignity and what have you, all the things that go with it. John, why don't you start us off, and then Eric, bring us over to the finish line.
That's a big question, and of course we really don't know exactly what's happening in the fighting, and it's really the way it comes out is going to depend on the fighting, I think. My own guess is that the Azeris will be fatigued as they get into the higher ground. The Armenians are also going to be exhausted and running out of supplies and fuel and so on. So I think a moment may come when the two sides will each decide to call it quits and go back to the negotiating table.
Eric?
Yeah, I largely agree with that. I mean, I think if anything, it's possible that the Azeris will take back some of the territory that, Armenian forces have been sitting in for some time. And so the balance of territorial acquisition may shift a little bit. Whether that actually makes it easier or harder to get to a longer term agreement as opposed to a ceasefire, I don't know. I think John would be better situated to say than I am.
And the notion of what happens in the event that it falls?
I mean, look, there's been ethnic cleansing, going on both sides you know, since this all started. I mean, as John pointed out in his earlier comments, this really began even before the Soviet Union fell back in 1988, when it was partly glasnost, but also the opening up of the nationalities issues, which ultimately undid the Soviet Union. And this was part and parcel of it.
Right. Well, and Eugene, just to sort of wrap on you, right, from a Russian perspective, then Moscow doesn't have to do anything. And then there's a warning that goes to everybody, you know, in the region. This is what happens when I don't get involved. You may want me involved the next time around.
Well, not necessarily. I think if there is a, you know, sort of decisive route at this point, it would be obviously of the Armenian forces. I think Putin would feel compelled to intervene. Not to intervene would completely hollow out the security guarantee, notwithstanding the claim that, oh, this is not Armenia proper and so on. But I think he would have to do something. Otherwise, it would be embarrassing for him. And it would really undercut the claim of being the kind of security provider for the region.
Is it problematic, the use of American weapons in a conflict like this? I mean, is it at all problematic for anybody in Washington that Turkey is using F-16s? In order to do this?
Oh, this has gone so far now with Yemen, other conflicts. I don't think anybody will notice.
I've read that the F-16s are actually produced in Turkey, but I don't know if that's true. Maybe Eric
knows. They're co-produced.
Yeah, they're co-produced.
The picture of the planes on the tarmac, I believe, is from the New York Times.
It is.
Video. So that's a, you know, I take that as a fairly reliable, credible source.
Well, although there's some question about whether they're actually F-16s or not. I actually think the F-16s are, because the Armenians, you know, allege that the F-16s shot down an Armenian aircraft, there's been a focus on F-16s. If you look at what the Turks did in Libya, I think what's much more significant is the use of the UAVs, the TB2s and the Carju2s and the Harpies and all of that that the Israelis have sold them. The Turks made extremely good use of UAVs, developed not just the aircraft, the airframes, but also the tactics, you know, techniques and programmatics to use these things, procedures to great effect against, you know, Russian-backed Wagner Group and Haftar's army in Libya. And I think you're seeing the same thing now being used on the Armenians.
Eric, and I've heard the same thing. Do you know Fred Wary?
Yeah.
So Fred, on one of his trips, apparently got caught up in the fighting in Libya,
yeah,
and he was describing it, and he says that apparently the Haftar people and presumably Wagner people actually put their UAVs and the UAE apparently supplied UAVs,
yeah,
to the same effect,
yeah.
So this is.
And by the way, I mean, this is an example, Vago, of kind of the unintended consequences of when we don't sell people things, right? Why did the Turks build their own UAVs? Because we wouldn't sell them armed UAVs.
Right. Well, although I have to say the technology, you know, once upon a time, Eric, I would have wholeheartedly agreed with you on that. But it was fascinating to me that, and I think you may have still been in office, but I was in Jordan, and the Jordanians were coming up with some pretty sophisticated unmanned systems. And their thing was, well, we want this to be done sovereignty, and you know, we know you're using them to great effect, and we intend to move up the food chain. Right. And it was 10 years ago when I was in Dubai for the Dubai Air Show, and the Emiratis were developing similar systems, right? I mean, so it's at some point, I completely agree with you that it's much better to be selling them.
Yeah, but I mean, that's also because we didn't sell them to the Emiratis. I mean, the Emiratis wanted us to sell them armed Predator.
Yeah, no, that's true.
And we wouldn't. So, I mean, look, your argument is right, which is technology diffuses, and this stuff would have gotten out there probably eventually anyway. But at a minimum, I think our failure to, in part because we were constrained by MTCR, which was developed to do something different before these things even existed, but we hung ourselves up in all of this. And at a minimum, it was an accelerant to people getting their own, you know, capability.
Right. All right.
What I understand in the case of Karabakh is that the Azeri and Turkish use of the drones has been extremely effective in suppressing the Karabakhi air defenses. But of course, it hasn't really enabled them to take territory as such.
Well, I mean, and we should note, right, it was the sale of Harpy to the Chinese that precipitated you, Eric, to take the biggest 2x4 I've seen the United States take out of its arsenal and
apply to its Israeli ally.
Well, I mean, right. But I mean, at the time, I remember, I mean, it was kind of an unprecedented moment, right?
Yeah, I got the director general of the Israeli Minister of Defense fired. So, right. Yeah. But I mean, to John's point, which I think is really important. So they've used the UAVs really effectively against the, you know, air defenses, but they haven't really been able to provide their ground forces with really good close, you know, combat air support. And that's slowed them up. That's one reason why they haven't been on the ground taking as much territory as they might otherwise. And that's where the terrain and the weather come in, and why we may get to the stalemate John and I were talking about that might facilitate, you know, more of a diplomatic effort to, you know, bring this to a conclusion, or at least a armistice.
Guys, thanks very, very much for joining us for what was a fascinating conversation. Look forward to having you guys on again, because the unfortunate thing is that this does not look like it's getting resolved despite the high loss of life on both sides. Thanks very, very much again. Really appreciate it.
Good to be with you.
All the best.
Thanks, Fargo. Great to be with you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.